All right, hello and welcome back to Real Seekers. I'm your host, Dale, the Real Seeker. And today we have a very special episode. It's something that we want to engage the audience with. We need your help essentially for today because I'm bringing on a special guest who has a special mission today. So in the first place, how's it going over there, Guy?
Fantastic. You know, I love your introduction. I love the way you have that video. That is just awesome. Yeah, so today, Dale, thank you so much for having us on. And we do have something very, very special, but it's a real big request. And that is, and we'll be talking more about it, but basically what I would need to do and what I'm asking is to have people sign a petition that we're going to be putting together, well, that we have put together, that we're going to be publishing and that we're then going to be demanding of Nature magazine to do a retraction of one of their articles from 1989.
Absolutely. And obviously, we're going to get into that and find out a little bit more details about what exactly are the specifics on this. I've posted the link to the petition in the YouTube description. I'm also going to post it in the live chat because I can see we've already got quite a lively chat. But before we get into the details of today's show, Guy, I'm sure I have some in the audience who've have been living under a rock and they've never heard of you. So why don't we first just take some time to kind of introduce the audience as to who you are, some stuff about your faith journey, and also about your involvement with the Shroud in general.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, going way back, and I think I'm probably typical with many Christians. So I grew up in a Christian household, and it was my mom that was really the one that brought us to Christ and brought us to church every Sunday and stuff like that. And then, unfortunately, when I went to college, then I kind of forgot about that. And so I was in church most of the time. And then in college, unfortunately, kind of stepped away. And although I didn't really step away from the teachings and everything that I knew from Christianity, but certainly stopped going to worship and things like that. And it wasn't until maybe about 10 years later, maybe a little bit longer, that I really came back and got into being, much stronger in my faith journey and really understanding that this is critical to life and to my family, and did everything possible that we could to bring Christ to our kids, and then working from there to then, hopefully bring Christ to to others outside of just our family. You mentioned the Shroud of Turin. The Shroud of Turin, I started to get involved in that about 20 years ago. My brother sent me a book on it from Ian Wilson of and it's called The Blood in the Shroud. And I read that and I says, oh man, this is just incredible. What a proof of the existence and and more importantly, the resurrection, the proof of the resurrection, which is the seminal moment for all of Christianity, is the resurrection. Without the resurrection, there is, maybe there would be Christianity, but it certainly wouldn't be as important or as meaningful as it is with the resurrection. And from that, I put together a book. It's called The Only Witness, and that really brought me deep and deep into understanding and studying the Shroud. And with that, then all of the tumultuous and politics and controversy surrounding it. And I know you have a series on the Shroud, and and you can, I can't remember the exact name of it, but it's really to bring, both sides of the Shroud together. So.
Absolutely, yeah. One thing you mentioned about Guy's book, he was actually on my show previously talking about his book when it came out, and it was really interesting because his book, it's not sort of the standard Shroud book that you get. He wrote it from as a fiction novel, basically telling certain fictional stories which correlate to the actual proposed history of the Shroud of Turin. So I think that's great. Yeah, and I know Joe Marino's working with famous Hollywood actor Rob Schneider on making an actual Hollywood movie on the Shroud of Turin to bring that into pop culture. So it's good that we have different ways of getting to people, and we also even a video game. There may be a Shroud video game coming up in the future at some point. Who knows? So,
Yeah. Well, and that's what I when I wrote the book, that's what I wanted to do was The problem with the shroud and studying the shroud is it gets nothing wrong with that. It's very scientific, very factual, and you know, different arguments and how this means this and that and all of the different pieces of it. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to go to a wider audience, and the wider audience then would be more likely to read a fiction book that's based on history. So it's called a historical fiction on the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. And as a historical fiction, then it brings in as many facts as I could, tells a story so it's readable and understandable, but then it's also told in a Christian way, so the Christian messages and everything else that are coming through, that come through the book, so that as you're reading it, you're understanding the history of the shroud, the potential, you know, faith journey that somebody might want to follow, and then do it in a very entertaining way.
Absolutely. And you'll be happy to know in the live chat, you've already got someone signing the petition, and we haven't even covered it. So we're off to a great start. So
fantastic. That is so good. Well, you know, one thing I did, and I always like to mention, when I wrote the book, I wanted to, my goal was to bring just one person to Christ. And, you know, certainly the people that are reading the book might be Christian already. But nevertheless, I'm hoping to get non-Christians to read it. But it's also opened up a whole bunch of other avenues for me to promote the Word of God and to promote the teachings of Jesus Christ, and hopefully to bring even more than one. I want to bring as many as I can, but definitely just one. If I can get just one, then I will have been successful.
Awesome. So yeah, I think at this point, without further ado, let's get into the reason why you're here. What is this petition that KR is going ahead and signing there? What is this petition all about that you've got going on?
Absolutely. And thank you for the signature. So what's going on is the Shroud of Turin has been, I believe, and as an authenticist, I believe is the true burial cloth of Jesus Christ. And but unfortunately, there are a lot of naysayers. And in 1988, there was a radiocarbon dating of the shroud. And that radiocarbon dating was flawed in a huge number of ways. It's just hard to believe that that you could have scientists that believe in facts and leading, you know, from facts and theories to then come up with a date that that was totally devoid of proper scientific rigor and everything like that. So they so what happened is in 1988, this radiocarbon dating was done. The result of that dating was that that the date of the shroud was somewhere between AD 1260 to AD 1390, and of course with that exclamation point at the end, and that just stabbed so many authenticists right in the heart and says it just kind of blew everybody away, and really it stopped shroud research for quite a while. Now in 1988, that was in October, the results were announced, and then Nature magazine, which is really one of the best well-known peer-reviewed scientific magazines, published an article that was supposedly peer-reviewed by a little over 20 different scientists that said, yep, this dating is correct. The date of the shroud, or the age of the shroud, was 1260 AD to 1390 AD. And therefore, the shroud is a fraud. It's not the authentic burial cloth of Jesus Christ. Now, since then, the shroud world kind of, you know, stepped back and, you know, put their tail between their legs for a little bit and started to really dive back and say, how could this be? You know, here we have 20 or 30 other studies, reasons why the shroud is true. Here we have one that says it's false and it's a fraud. And so they kind of stepped back, and then they started to delve into it a little bit further. And they started to realize that there is something wrong with the way that the process that took place, the methodology, the scientific methodology of how that dating was done, was absolutely flawed. And those flaws then were not exposed in the Nature magazine. And so the petition that I'm talking about right now is that we want to then, we have uncovered the flaws. We know that the radiocarbon dating has been totally debunked. And we want Nature magazine to rewrite their article to either retract it or amend it. So now the Nature magazine article came out on February 16th, 1989. So a couple of months after the release of the or the announcement of the radiocarbon results. And that is the article that we want retracted. And we are then putting a petition together where hopefully we can get, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people to sign that petition. And then with that petition, we're going to write a letter to the editor in chief of the of Nature magazine. And we are then going to, you know, really do a full court press on getting her to retract or amend that article.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. And one thing I'll just say is that, look, this isn't just a pro Shroud thing. Even if you're Hugh Ferry, if you're the ultimate Shroud skeptic, you should still be on board and sign this petition because you should be supporting the truth, right? You don't want, look, it's making your side look bad. Oh, you people have this flawed data and this is the best the skeptics can come up with. No, you should want to get this thing retracted too. So this is for both Shroud skeptics and pro Shroud guys. Now, now there is one thing you mentioned in terms of the flaws of the process. Did you kind of want to take some time to, what were yes. some of these flaws in it? I know you have a video as well. Do you know how to share your screen if you're?
No, I don't. Let me just talk through them if you wouldn't mind. That would be, I wasn't prepared necessarily to share, but I do have a video that I took all of these points from, and that's from Michael Kowalski. And it is awesome. It is really, really well done. And the title of it, I believe, is The Flawed Shroud of Turin Carbon Dating Report by Michael Kowalski. And he is with the BSTS, which is the British Shroud of Turin Society, I think it is, or the British Society of Turin Shroud.
That's it.
And it's really just amazing. He did a great job. So he came up with about 9 or 10 different bullets on the methodology itself. The first one that he came up with was that the original process, the agreed on process, and then the actual process. The agreed on process was that there were going to be 7 different carbon dating laboratories that were going to take a sample from the shroud and then use that to be dated by those 7 labs. And then the results were then going to be compiled and then a summary report would be developed. Well, that fell through. They only took 3 labs. So instead of 7, they took 3. They were going to use 2 different carbon dating methods. Now, I don't quite understand exactly how those work, but they were going to use 2 different methods. And just so that they'd have as many controls as possible in terms of how the methodology was going to work. Well, instead of using 2, they only did 1. The process was supervised by the British Museum. Good for them. I mean, you would expect the British Museum being a globally recognized museum and certainly with a lot of science and rigor behind them. And you would not expect them to cover things up. We'll talk about that in a minute. So then the other thing that's critical when you're going to do a sampling of an archaeological relic like the shroud or anything is you want to take samples from different areas because there might just be certain things, contaminants or changes or something that might have affected it. It might be dirty over here and clean over there or something, you know, in a different spot. So they were originally going to take samples from 3 different areas. And they only took it from 1. So all of the little samples were just from 1 little area in the on the shroud, and that was it. The most recognized number of scientists that understood the shroud really to the best at that time were the STIRP scientists. And the STIRP, standing for the Shroud of Turin Research Project, they went over in 1978, and they did 5 full days, 120 hours of study, all kinds of different scientific studies on the image and everything. And they were then, they ended up coming up with the conclusion that they could not determine how the image was made. It was not a paint, a dye, a scorch, and all of these other things that they came up with. And they were going to have the STIRP scientists, really the best and brightest, in the world, to be able to do that. And they were also going to be the ones that were going to cut the samples from these three different areas. The politics that were involved, they were pushed to the side, and then there was a whole different group that actually did the cutting of the samples. The labs themselves needed to then take the samples and date them. And the samples that they took were supposed to be then disguised, and they were going to be given three samples. So they were going to be given one sample, a disguised sample of the shroud, a disguised sample of something else, and a disguised sample of something else. So they were going to get three samples disguised, and they would not know which one was which. And unfortunately, they were given two samples, one as a control and one as the test sample from the shroud. And they could recognize the shroud because they could see the herringbone weave that was in the shroud. So that was not done. They knew exactly which one they were dating. So it was not like a blind, a blind test that you'd often, hear about in the news. So those samples were then identifiable, not unidentifiable. So that one was not done. That method was not followed. Then the results. So if those were blind samples, then those results were going to be sent blindly to the British Museum. And the British Museum then, as the authority, was then going to summarize all the results and put them into a report and run the statistics on it and everything like that. That did not happen. The results were shared across the labs. They were shared across other folks, and so it was not kept confidential. And that also then means that there could have been collaboration or other kinds of things that were just wrong. The labs were supposed to be testing concurrently and independently. That one, I believe, actually took place. Once the results were received by the British Museum, then three different groups were going to run the statistics. Now, I don't know about you, Dale, but I took statistics in college, and I hated statistics.
I took it my first year. I did well in it, but after that, I was like, nope, I'm done.
Yeah, I just couldn't get this. How could you predict something based on, the history? I don't know. It was just, I absolutely hated it. I did okay with it, but I don't know. I just hated it. Now, here we are back. And with the Shroud of Turin, the statistics were either fraudulently done or incorrectly done at best. And we'll talk about that here in a little bit, but that is a huge piece as to why these results just didn't work out. And then at the end of all of that, the institutions that were the statistics guys had to then have a kind of a joint agreement with the labs that they have properly assimilated those results and properly studied them and then put them into the right format so that they all agree and it really makes sense. And that was not done. So here we have a set of 9 or 10 bullets that really are the key to the methodology so that you have blind testing, you have complete control, you have confidentiality, et cetera, et cetera. And all of them were not followed. And that right there is a huge, huge piece.
Absolutely. And we've got some good comments just following up. Again, your number one fan guy, he's saying he's predicting 1 million people will sign yep. this. So
I'm ready for that.
And we've got our mutual friend, Joe Marino. You were talking about those alternate methods. So Joe Marino is saying the older carbon-14 method was called proportional counting and required about a handkerchief size piece. The new method was AMS. So that's what Harry Gove invented, which could carbon date things with just threads. And it just says, follows up, the labs were actually told the dates of the control samples. So that guy mentioned that these were supposed to be, as per proper scientific methodology, blind tests, and they were not blind. There was an active, for lack of a better word, conspiracy.
Yep.
They worked together. They told each other. Yep.
And personally, I think there was a conspiracy. And Now, you know, it's hard to prove it. So it's maybe let's call it an alleged conspiracy. But, you know, at the end of the day, the labs made a ton of money because they got the notoriety that they have proven that this relic, this incredibly fascinating, incredibly valuable relic, Christian relic, and they were able to prove it wrong. And basically thumb their noses at, you know, at Christianity and at, you know, at all of these shroud scientists. Now, I do have to interject one thing. Joe, thank you so much. Joe has been instrumental in me putting this stuff together. And he, you know, he's just a wonderful resource. And I can only thank him enough. And actually, you know, he's given me a handful of references and stuff like that. So I just need to you know, send a shout out to Joe Marino.
Awesome. Awesome. All right, cool. So I know you've kind of already answered this on one front, but I wanted to get from you because I know that you have two goals specifically with this petition. So do you want to just kind of outline specifically what those two goals are, just to make it clear for the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you. The primary one is to get a retraction from Nature magazine. And that retraction will then hopefully, you know, bring to the forefront that the shroud and the doubters of the shroud or the anti-authenticists of the shroud, they can't rely anymore on that article. They have to then say that, yep, the radiocarbon dating that was done was absolutely flawed. And therefore, you know, that kind of takes one of takes the wind out of the sails of the non-authenticists. And I think that's really critical. So our goal is to, first of all, for today is get people to sign this petition. And then as we move the process along is we are going to send a retraction letter and a demand, hopefully to the editor in chief of Nature magazine. And then I hope the other thing is then for people to realize that this shroud, the Shroud of Turin, is really possibly the proof of the resurrection, that it really is, something that Christians can kind of hold on to and realize that, yes, that seminal moment in history 2,000 years ago not only happened based on our faith and understanding, but now there's proof over here. You know, so for those that are like the doubting Thomas that really want to put their fingers into the wound and put their fingers into the hands and into the feet, that they now, that they have something then to fall back on. And then lastly, actually, maybe it's a third goal is I always want to bring more people to Christ. And if this can help them to help people to get over the hump and say, yes, I now believe, then that would be even more wonderful.
Awesome. Awesome. So I'm kind of curious about the mechanics, because I've never been involved in anything like this before. So I'm just sort of curious, like how typically do you know how it works? Like how many signatures typically does it take to actually make an impact where we would get these kind of results? And in answering that, I'd also like to know, what do you think is really the biggest challenge in accomplishing your goals with this petition?
Well, yeah, you know, I looked up and I tried to find some research that said, you know, how many do we actually need? Okay, so, you know, one or two people, you and me, Dale, that ain't gonna cut it. But I think when we get into the hundreds, I think we've got enough. If we get into the thousands, then we're definitely there. I did look at, you know, like the number of people like if you wanted to have a law rescinded or something like that, or get something on the ballot, you know, some kind of a resolution on the ballot, then you'd have to have a certain number of signatures. And that's usually in the 10,000s or tens of thousands or, you know, or something like that. I think even if you wanted to be a candidate for office, you need to have a certain number of signatures as well. So it kind of, you know, there it goes into the and I guess depending upon the level of the office you're seeking, it, you know, there's a certain number there that's necessary. I think here it's more a question of just getting as many signatures as we can, regardless of whether I get, you know, 10 signatures or 100 or 1,000 or 1,000,000. I am going to, you know, to keep pushing on this, and I am going to submit this letter of retraction to Nature magazine, to the editor in chief, and make sure that, you know, that this actually comes to fruition. Because it's a crime. It is truly a crime that this took place. When I think about, you know, I know that picture that you see with the blackboard behind them and the three men sitting at the table. You've got, you know, Michael Tite in the middle. You got Professor Hall, and I can't remember the other name at the moment. And they're sitting there. They're watching the. They're doing their press announcement, and they have 1260 to 1390 exclamation point. And I think it's Professor Hall. He was asked the question, well, how did all of this happen? And he says, well, they just faked it up and flogged it, you know, going back for the fight and faked it up and flogged it. Well, you know, I'm not going to say a curse word on here, but, you know, bleep, bleep, bleep me. And there's the picture. Thank you. Perfect. Yeah. They are the ones that faked it up and flogged it. And it really, you know, what goes around comes around. And for them, what went around is now coming back around to them. And it upsets me to no end that they had such a negative impact on all of Shroud research and that could have been taking place over the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing, it's such a shame because they knew, I mean, there were carbon 14 scientists warning and saying, look, this should for, you know, certain things should not be published in the peer review, and Nature just went ahead with it and stuff. So I don't know. I have no idea if any of those people are even still alive at this point, but have you contacted maybe actual experts who may have spoken against it, or scientists who are speaking against this? Have you reached out for any support in that?
Speaking against the dating?
Yeah, the Nature Journal. There.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, and I have on our website, guypowell.com, I put links to a handful of articles. And again, thanks to Joe Marino that he did it. He also has, he wrote a book, and I'll show it to you here. It's called the 1988 C14 carbon 14 dating of the Shroud, a stunning expose. And I've read this, and it's I don't know. I thought it was just fascinating. There was so much politics. When you read this, you can see the politics between the different labs or the different scientists. These guys over here didn't like those guys over there. You have then the religious side of it. You got the international side of it, and it all is in this book. And this really is the true source of everything that you know, that has to do with what happened with the dating of the Shroud. And again, thanks to Joe, what a great work this really is. And it's available, by the way, on Amazon. It's definitely, if you're interested in finding out what happened, that is it. Now, there's a handful of other papers that I have been referencing. And I think the other one that's kind of interesting is the one from Tristan Casabianca. And he is the one of the things that happened with the 88 dating was that the British Museum did not publish the raw data. Normally, in any kind of a scientific study, you publish the raw data. You want people to, you know, to find flaws in it. And if they don't find it, then that's a good thing for you. That's something that you can, you know, hang your hat on, so to speak. And they hid the data. And I don't know if it was on purpose. I kind of tend to, you know, to think that way, that they were purposefully not hiding the data. They did a couple of weird things with, as we know, with the statistics. And it was Tristan Casabianca, and his paper is called Radiocarbon Dating of Turin Shroud, New Evidence from Raw Data. He forced the British Museum, through a Freedom of Information Act request, to get the raw data. And when he got the raw data, what came out of it was absolutely stunning. Now, that took place, I believe, in the early 2000s. And then since then, that raw data is now out there. And there's a handful of other studies that have been done to look at that. Paolo Di Lazzaro and some of the other ones that have done some studies on the data to really, you know, show that the statistics was all wrong. And, you know, and one of the things that's kind of fascinating is on the statistics is, and I'm sorry I'm doing so much talking here, but I'm just energized. It's, it, you know,
you got to be passionate about this. Yeah.
Well, so on the statistics, what's just fascinating is if you put all of the samples back in line based on the dates that were done, there's this thing called systematic error. Now, if you have no systematic error, the averages of all the dates, because there's always going to be little errors and little, you know, whenever you measure something, you know, is it 16.01 inches or 16.02 or 15.09, you know, something like that. You're going to get tiny little variations based on how you measure stuff. And so you would expect that. But you would expect that everybody that does that measurement then comes up with something that follows the mean. And now, with these measurements, there were three samples, four samples cut, one for the Arizona lab, one for the Oxford lab, and one for the Zurich lab. And then there was a second little piece that was given over to the Arizona lab. And when they were kind of finally aligned, if the averages were the same, then that would mean that there would be a straight line and the dates came out to 1260 to 1390. Well, that is not what happened. What happened is the further you got away from the center of the shroud, the older the date was. And so then you'd have, let's say, 1260 on the first one, and then maybe 1270, 1280, 1290, da, 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 1390. And if you and so that error, that difference there is called systematic bias. The systematic error, it was not tending towards the mean. It was actually had another component in it that was not being measured. And if you follow that to its logical conclusion, you'd actually have a date in the center of the shroud, which is into the future, which is something that they hid. You know, that not only did they fake it up and flog it, but they hid it. You know, so it's kind of fascinating that, you know, that they were able to hide that for like 20 years. And so anyway, that was one of the huge things that came out of the work and the research and the FOIA request that Tristan Casabianca and then others, Paolo De Lazario and others that did that.
Yeah, so it's obvious. Look, with this work, this carbon dating that was done and the subsequent paper and journal, there are massive falsehoods here, right? For example, just what you were saying, right? They just attributed the trend in these 12 subsamples that they took. They just dismissed it literally mindlessly as random measurement error. Oh, it's nothing to see here. And then, of course, betraying the fact that they were kind of lying, they hid that data, meaning they knew there was that systemic trend. Systematic bias just means it's a linear trend in one direction, meaning it's not random measurement error. But yeah, that's just one of the errors. I'm curious, what are some of the other falsehoods that we know that have come to light since the 1988 carbon-14 data that we should know about as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and sorry, one more comment on the systematic error. The systematic error is one of those things where if you're a true scientist and you saw that systematic error, so if the British Museum was being run by true scientists at that time and they saw that systematic error, they would have said, you know, OMG, what happened here? What's going on here? We need to investigate further. We need to understand further. And instead, like you said, they swept it under the rug, they hid it, and then they published their supposed results that was there. Okay, so one thing though, I think what's interesting is I think though that the dating of the material that they received was probably done correctly. I think all of the labs, based on what they did, they really did come up with whatever the sample that they had, they did the radiocarbon part of it correctly. It was then the work that was done before that and the work that was done after that was then incorrect. Now, the work that was done before that was the taking of the sample. Now, originally, there were supposed to be a number of different spots where the sample was going to be taken from. that was thrown out the window, number one. And so that meant that you're just getting what the date is of that corner little piece that's on the shroud. Now, and Joe Marino, again, which, you know, he has done so much work in this area. He and Sue Benford wrote a paper that said that where the sample was taken, that there could have actually been a repair made. It's called a reweave, an invisible reweave, and that reweave could have been woven out of a mix of modern cotton and ancient linen. And so when you mix modern with ancient, then you're going to come up with something in the middle. So possibly one of the reasons why the answers came up to the 1260 to 1390 was it was possibly a repair of material from, let's say, the 1600s that had cotton in it that was repaired and then gets averaged in within the linen from the first century. And then somewhere in the middle, that comes out to that 1260 to 1390. That actually could possibly make sense. And so that's one theory, was that the samples were not pure linen samples of the original shroud. They were of the repaired area. And that's definitely an interesting contention, and one that we hope to, I think we all hope to have resolved at some point, if we ever get, you know, some access back to the shroud, to be able to understand whether there actually is cotton in that corner there. And then potentially take another sample from, you know, a couple of other places, and then truly, radiocarbon date them as well. Now, one of the other things that was also done wrong may have been done wrong is that there was not a good and consistent way that the samples were cleaned. So that particular corner and all of that one edge were handled by the bishops as they were exhibiting the shroud, and the picture behind me kind of shows that. That's from 1613, an exhibition outside of the royal palace in Italy, and they're holding on to it, and they're squeezing it like that. So it, over the centuries, if they're doing that, then the oils and the dirt and the whatever is going to contaminate that one area, and so that's going to potentially also lead to a mix of new material versus old material for the carbon dating, and also then, you know, affect the actual carbon dating.
Gotcha. One thing that just it amazes me is you mentioned that thing last where about ordinary contamination. And I know that Pam Moon, she's went to Oxford Labs, and she's claimed to still have found, even after the cleaning procedures, that there was still some contaminant evident there. Now, what's interesting to me is that this seems to be the gambit of the shroud skeptics now. It's the shroud skeptics who are desperate because of this systematic bias that we've scientifically proven. Now they're saying, oh, well, maybe the carbon lab, maybe they were incompetent. Maybe they left some contamination on, and that's why we have this bias. What are your thoughts on that reversal where the skeptics, oh, carbon 14 scientists, they're perfect, they can never be wrong. But then when it's proven they get something wrong, oh, well, okay, maybe they missed something. It's no big deal. Nothing to see here. What do you think of that reversal?
Yeah, well, I think, I hate to say it, I mean, everybody has their own worldview. And if you've had a worldview for, you know, a lifelong or, you know, a long time, then it's very hard to change your worldview. And if something comes along that kind of disproves this one argument, then you're going to, you're going to flail around to find another argument to support your worldview. And I hate to say it, we're all guilty of that. I know I'm guilty of it. I have my worldview, and I'm sure you do. And it is hard. It is very hard. And so the skeptics, you know, God bless them, the skeptics, they have their worldview, and then they're going to, you know, try and find reasons to find a result. Now, I will have to admit, I personally think the skeptics add a lot of value to shroud research. And you mentioned Hugh Farry. Some of the skeptics are very good at finding flaws in the authenticists' arguments, and that just makes us better. That makes overall us better. And we have to, if we want true scientific rigor, we need to be able to face the skeptics. And if they find a flaw in our argument, fantastic. Let's go off and fix it. The skeptics actually do add a lot of value. And personally, I'm writing a paper right now, and Hugh Farry has written a paper on a couple of things. And I took his arguments, and that helped me to make my work even better. So in that respect, you know, I appreciate both sides of the equation, because it really does make the authenticist work a little bit harder to get to truly the right answer, hopefully.
Yeah. Well said. Iron sharpens iron, right? And I think there are definitely very knowledgeable shroud skeptics out there that help the pro shroud case. They improve and help us to strengthen the pro shroud case for sure and stuff. So, all right. Well said. Well, I think I know you've already spoken about Joe Marino's book. Is there anything else about Joe Marino's book in particular that you'd like us to know? And I'd also like to ask you about Larry Schwalbe's paper as well, because that's a critical piece of the puzzle to know about as well.
Yeah, and that one, I didn't get a chance to, I read that one a ways back, and I didn't get a chance to read it. I was trying to read it last night, and I got interrupted with a honeydew, so I had to clean the deck. So Larry Schwalbe and Brian Walsh, his paper is called On Cleaning Methods and the Raw Radiocarbon Data from the Shroud of Turin. And that one then talks about, you know, what are the right ways to clean that linen to make sure that, you know, all of those contaminants that came potentially from all of the hand oils of all of the bishops and whatever that had held onto the shroud. And that Pam, even, you know, Pam Moon, you mentioned, where she said she did find some residual contamination on that piece. And his book and his paper, Larry Schwalbe's paper, is about that. Is there really a good way to clean the linen so that you truly have just the linen that is going to be carbon dated? And I apologize, I can't really add too much more of that.
No worries. All right. So the last thing you wanted me to ask you about is, again, I keep hearing about this Michael Kowalski video. I hope I've seen it, but I'm not sure exactly which one you guys are all talking about. But what is it about this Michael Kowalski video that's got even the most pro-shred experts, Bob Rucker and you, so hyped up about it?
Yeah, it's found on YouTube, and it's called The Flawed Shroud of Turin Carbon Dating Report? ?
And I'm a good boy. So
he goes through what was the original testing plan and then what happened to it, and it's really kind of interesting. So when he talked about the seven labs, he then puts an X next to it and say, "Oh, there's only three." He talks about two different carbon dating methods, and he puts an X next to it, and there's only one. And then he talks about there's 9 or 10 different bullets that he does that with, which is really good. And then he talks about the mistakes that the British Museum makes. So, for example, they didn't disclose all the test results. They inflated the Arizona margin of error. So normally when you get a set of numbers that you're measuring, you know, like a piece of wood or whatever, 16.1 and 16.05 and 15.9 and whatever, you get a margin of error that you can say, well, it's somewhere on each one of those measures, somewhere in there, there's some level of error based on, you know, the way that the measurement method works out. And they took the Arizona margin of error and then they inflated it so that it would correspond with the other two labs and their margins of error, so that you could then say, okay, let's take the average of those. And then I don't know about you, but they did one other thing. It's called a rounding up error or a rounding error. Yeah. So normally when you round a number, if it's like you're going to go from 4 to 4.49, that gets rounded down to 4. If you go 4.5 to 4.99, that gets rounded up to 5. And now the way I like to do rounding, especially when I'm trying to, you know, make myself look good as I, you know, I'd say, well, I had two of these here. So, oh, that's almost five. So let me round that up to five. And then, well, if I had five, that means I had 10. I'm at 10. And then if you're at 10, hey, listen, if I had 10, I'm almost at 20, right? Well, so what the British Museum did is they took the number, and it's in his video, 4.176. Normally, you know, you and me as, you know, having gone to college and even in high school, we would round that down to 4.0. And the British Museum rounded that up to a 5. And, you know, you just can't make, and I don't know if that's a mistake or, okay, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, but that sounds like they're trying to hide something. And it's probably more on the hiding of something as opposed to, you know, an honest mistake. How could you round up? Nobody in the world, other than me, of course, when I round up my one up to 20, but, you know, how could you round up 4.176 to 5? That gets round down in a scientific way down to 4, period. And, you know, end of discussion, so to speak. And
Go ahead. I was just going to make a stupid joke. I was going to say, it sounds like you're qualified to work for the British Museum there. So,
I'm ready.
There you go. Start that rounding, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Then
there are a couple of other things. You know what? It's hard. And as I've been getting involved in this, I've been, you know, trying to understand what peer review means and how that works. And peer review is really tough because, you know, here you have, let's say, you know, a couple of scientists, the British Museum, you know, Professor Hall, Michael Tite, and the third one. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name.
Robert Hedges. Joe Marino gave the answer in the
chat. Wonder, Joe, thanks a lot. Robert Hedges. And and so normally then you'd write your paper and then you'd submit it to other scientists. And each of those, well, you'd submit it to, let's say, Nature magazine, and Nature magazine would say, well, there's some statistics in here, so I'm going to submit this to a couple of statisticians. There's some nuclear whatever in here, so I'm going to, you know, give it to nuclear measurement guys. There's some archaeology in here, so I'm going to have it reviewed by a couple of archaeology guys. But they don't get the full data set necessarily. And in many cases, they don't get it. And so therefore, they're reading the paper and they're saying, yeah, this kind of makes sense. But unless they actually see the data and they can actually redo the effort and the measurement, then they can really only express an opinion. So now the Nature article was reviewed by 21 different scientists. I think it's a Nature article that was reviewed by 21 scientists. But again, they peer reviewed it, but they didn't necessarily redo all of the work to make sure that it was done right. And I think, you know, that is a problem with the scientific peer review process, in that it is definitely not, you know, not 100%. There's, you know, you would think that they would be, you know, do more there to be a little bit more accurate. And a little bit more circumspect in how they do their reviews. Now, I don't believe that the scientists get paid for that review. Maybe sometimes they do, but many times they don't get paid to do the review. So therefore, it kind of gets, you know, it gets put off. It's not a high priority thing. And then, you know, then they look at it and they say, yeah, it makes sense. So I'm going to say, yep, it looks right, as opposed to really spending the time and digging into a lot of detail and really understanding what's behind it. And it kind of says something, at least for the 1989 and the 1988 radiocarbon testing and the 1989 article, that the peer review was probably not as rigorous as, you know, as we would have liked, you know, us authenticists would have liked.
Awesome. All right, cool. Well, I think I've covered all the things you wanted me to ask about in terms of this petition, but just before I look to the audience to see if they have any questions, is there anything I've missed that you think is really important that we need to know about in terms of this current mission?
Well, one thing that Michael Kowalski also brought up is after the radiocarbon dating, what is the one big thing that, you know, you would not want to see a scientist have happen or a scientific result influencing, and that is the lucre, the money. And the labs, they received donations of from the ITV of 100,000 British pounds, and then £1 million from 45 businessmen. So there was something going on there, and allegedly, of course, is that there was something going on there to come up with this incorrect, potentially incorrect answer. And so then they didn't do the scientific research, so to speak, to do pure research. They ended up making a lot of money at it, and I think that also kind of, you know, seals the deal, so to speak, on their potentially, you know, not so above board intentions with what they did.
Yeah, and I think even Barry Schwartz mentions that Tite in particular got some lavish teaching job, or just right after the thing, all of a sudden he gets this lavish, lucrative post as a job there. So yeah, there's definitely something fishy. And I find that with a lot of the Shroud skeptics, like, you know, Luigi Garlicelli and his work, it's always funded by some anonymous atheist organization, or Joe Nickel, you know, working for the Skeptical Inquirer. There definitely seems like there's a question. Is this really unbiased, neutral research, yeah, or is there an agenda? So, yeah.
Well, and that actually, you know, with STIRP and everything, that was one of the criticisms of STIRP, is that, well, they're just a bunch of religious zealots. Of course, they're going to come up with that, with those answers that they came up. And then, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, Barry Schwartz goes, hold on a second, you know, what about me? I'm not a Christian, you know, and there were, you know, a handful of non-Christians on STIRP. And so, you know, all of a sudden that argument falls away. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, STIRP, but it was made up of a whole bunch of people. I think Barry said that there was three Jews, there was an atheist or agnostic, one Mormon. So the pro Shroud side, I mean, even on my own channel, on my Shroud War series, I've had Muslims, I've had a non-religious Jew, Barry Schwartz, I've had a non-religious agnostic, John Loken, on the show. So yeah, the evidence really is strong, and it's not, yeah, only, yeah, Christians who are pro Shroud. All right, cool. Well, let me, there's no direct questions, but I do have some points that I think relate to questions. So this is kind of what we just mentioned, right? So KR is mentioning that they were paid off. You've kind of went into that, but I'm sort of curious, do you think that there's merit to considering some of the conspiracy theories as an explanation for the Shroud? So for example, some people have claimed that the sample was actually switched when Tite went into the back room off camera. Do you think there's any merit to that, or is that, no, that those are just conspiracy?
Yeah, those are tough. I mean, absolutely no question about it that the provenance of the samples were broken when, for whatever reason, they took the samples out from the room where the Shroud is. They went off in the back room and they didn't allow that to be videotaped. And you wonder what were they thinking, if they really wanted to have a good answer there. And it just, unfortunately, it lends doubt in what happened. And the worst thing is let's say that they did that, and the provenance was broken, it was hidden from the video camera, and the dating came out to be first century. Well, then all of the Shroud skeptics would have said, yeah, but the provenance was lost. It wasn't videotaped, so something must have happened in that back room there. So, you know, whether it came out to be 1260 to 1390 or first century, that breaking of that, you know, of that video stream there was incredibly unfortunate. And I don't know whether that would be a conspiracy. I don't know. I've read Joe's book. And, you know, it's certainly, there was so much politics going on, that maybe there was a kind of a latent kind of a conspiracy that was going on. But man, it just, you know, it's just a shame, I guess, if there was a conspiracy or not.
Absolutely. All right. So the next one is from Luke Williams. It's going to kind of put you on the spot a little bit. So I'm just curious, in terms of your own position. So Luke Williams is saying that he thinks that the carbon dating actually proves Bob Rucker's theory over and against the invisible reweave. Now, you've mentioned both theories. If you don't mind sharing, like, well, which is the theory that you personally go for and why, if you don't mind?
Yeah, I hate to say it. I go back and forth. I just, in prep for this call, I reread the Joe Marino and Sue Benford paper, Discrepancies in the Radiocarbon Dating Area of the Turin Shroud. And I will admit, the arguments that are made there are pretty compelling. They are very compelling. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a case that both things happened. You know, there was a vertically columnized radiation of some kind that caused the protons and neutrons to change the nitrogen into, you know, carbon-14. It's definitely that's also very possible. I like the research that Joe and Sue Benford did. I thought that was awesome. And definitely, if you haven't read that paper, it's definitely worth reading. And then the only problem that I have with Joe and Susan's paper is how did the dating of the sedarium, the face cloth, come up with a totally different date somewhere in the 700s or so? And whereas the Rucker theory kind of covers both of them. So I'm kind of, you know, torn between both of them. When I read Robert Ruckert's paper, then I go, oh yeah, this is absolutely right. And then I read Joe and Susan's paper and I go, oh yeah, this one's pretty good too. So I don't know. I hate to say it, I'm wishy-washy and 50-50 on them. So
fair enough. Well, the good news is, obviously, in terms of truth, they are both mutually exclusive. But for right now, we don't need to figure out the truth and figure it out, have it all figured out. The point is, the Shroud skeptic is the one claiming to know the Shroud is medieval on the basis of the carbon 14. So we can use evidence from both of these theories as ways to attack the epistemic rational justification for believing that. No, the Shroud skeptic has to answer both of these objections and come up with answers for all of this. So I see them as mutually reinforcing as an objection against the skeptic's claim. That's how I look at it. So
yeah, agreed on that. And that is a very good point. So hopefully, at some point in the near future, we will have another group of scientists that will go and actually determine whether there's cotton in that corner and an invisible reweave in that corner, and that there was nuclear radiation that then can prove then Rucker's theory, because both of them are well founded. So I just hope at some point the church will let us get in there and let us have at it and come up with some answers there.
Awesome. All right, cool. So this one's not a question, but just some more support. He's saying Guy's book is very good, definitely a worthy purchase. So make sure to
thank
buy
you.
Guy's book there.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
All right. And here's an interesting thing, right? So Sandra Dude is saying we need to take samples from different parts of the cloth. As you mentioned in your presentation, they only dated one sample location. Now, in my books, I've argued that right away is game over. Like, on that basis alone, you're not warranted in believing the Shroud is medieval. What's your take on that? Do you think the fact that they only dated a sample, is that game over for the skeptics? Or what do you think of Hugh, who says, no, that's perfectly good enough. We can believe it's medieval just on one sample.
Yeah, no, no question that it needs to be tested with different samples from different parts of the shroud. I know you're saying the image there, but I don't think you'd ever want to take a sample of the image itself and cut that out. So unfortunately, it would have to be somewhere else. I like to do test and repeat. I like to say, okay, let's start with a small thing, get an answer, but have the plan that we're going to do, this and then this and then this and then that. And, so as a first kind of a thing, it has raised all of the issues that we need to know so that when we do the second sample and the third and the fifth and the tenth or whatever it is, that we get those absolutely right, that we don't turn the video off, that we have complete agreement on what's going to go on. We have then absolute control samples so that everything is disguised. We have all of these other things so that it properly follows the methodology and that we can get past this rancor that's associated with the flaws in the methodology in the past.
Awesome. All right. This one is actually a proper question. So Psycho Gun Cobra asks, if during the resurrection, it has altered the material carbon-14 and made it look younger, will another carbon-14 test be costly to the shroud? Is carbon-14 not a reliable dating technique for certain things in general, I think?
Yeah, well, and I think what you mean by costly is, will it damage the shroud? Now, unfortunately, carbon-14 dating today is destructive. So when you make a cut out of the shroud to do the carbon-14 testing, then it burns it. What you do is you oxidize it, you burn it, and you get then just the carbon left over. And then what you do is you basically count the number of molecules of or elements of carbon-12 versus carbon-14, and it's that ratio. So unfortunately, it is costly to the shroud, and there will be some damage to the shroud. And then your second piece of the question is carbon-14 not reliable? Yes, it is absolutely a reliable for organic matter, but the critical piece is the contamination of that organic matter. And that's kind of where the cotton reweave, the invisible reweave comes in. Some of the other dating that might take place. So let's say that I found a mammal that was buried in the permafrost, and there was some tree roots somehow intermingled with the fur of that mammal, of that mammoth, and then when you go to date it, you need to make absolutely certain that you get rid of all of that modern material, so that you're only dating the material, the organic material of that, of that mammoth fossil that might have been in there, and that's pretty critical. And once that's done, and once you've proven that that's done, then you have, I think carbon-14 can be relatively reliable. And I think it's reliable up to about 50,000 years. I think older than 50,000 years, then you need to use some other technique. But it is, I think it is generally very reliable.
Yeah, just one correction. It used to be the case that it only went back 50,000. I think it's been extended now through one of the techniques. It's been a while since I looked at the details, but I think it can go back 100,000 years now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. And the thing is, what's going on is you're measuring and counting the number of carbon-14 versus carbon-12. And the ratio is like 1 to 1,000,000. It's a really, really tiny little amount of carbon-14. And as you get older and older, that million, one out of a million gets to be one out of 10 million, and then 100 million, and a billion. And so then the accuracy of counting those little molecules in there, the carbon-14 atoms, then that gets even harder and harder, and it leads to more inaccuracies or higher error bars on the measurements that you get.
Awesome. All right. Well, it looks like we have one last question. So be off the hook after that, off the hot seat here. But this one comes. Oh, okay. So maybe two more. But so here's this one from KR. And he's saying, look, why is it so important to have the carbon-14 date the way we want? What about all the other evidence that's just so astounding and proves the shroud's not medieval? So, yeah.
Very good question. Here you have, there's 20 or 30 or 50 other different tests or analyses that have been done that prove that the shroud existed before 1260 to 1390. And so, okay, so we have one, let's throw it out. The other ones kind of prove or show that it's at least from some time, in the first century. And to your point, that's very good. The challenge is, it's kind of like today, if you're on a jury trial, if you don't have DNA evidence, then the jury just isn't going to convict. And unfortunately, carbon-14 is kind of like the DNA of a jury trial. Everybody thinks that carbon-14 is the gold standard. And if it says something, then all of the other tests must be wrong. When in reality, if you have 20 or 50 other tests that show it's from the first century and the carbon-14 says it's the other way, then maybe you throw out that outlier, the carbon-14 outlier.
Gotcha. All right. And I know you're going to love this one. So, would you like to see your book turned into a film or series?
Absolutely, KR, I'm ready. So if you're ready, I'm ready. I'll tell you what, if you'll do it, I'll have you play Joseph of Arimathea after your resurrection.
There you go. There you go.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Awesome. So yeah, at this point, I think that covers it. So I want to say thank you so much for coming on and entrusting me to share this important petition. I was grateful to see a lot of people in the audience look like they're going to be supporting it. So I'm going to be signing it and getting everyone I know to sign it. So
Thank
yeah,
you.
it's really important. Again, we're not just broadcasting to real seekers. So Guy, we're on two podcasts for the price of one. We're also on Faith Unaltered, and the Faith Unaltered doesn't, I don't usually broadcast Shroud shows to that audience. So if you're new to this, I hope Guy has kind of whetted your appetite, because there's so much great evidence for the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin. And as you can see, the carbon dating, deeply flawed. It's garbage. Even if you want to still believe the Shroud's a medieval fake because you're new to it, the carbon 14 is still flawed. And if you're interested in truth, even as a Shroud skeptic, you should be backing us up and getting this horrible paper from 1989 retracted, because it is the very definition of pseudoscience. So pro Shroud, Shroud skeptic, let's unite in the name of truth and get rid of this thing. So yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you. And again, thank you so much, Dale. And Joe, by the way, thank you as well. I really appreciate all your support and everything. And also, please sign that petition and get your friends, publish it out to your Facebook and any other lists that you've got, and let's get this thing retracted. And hope that for me leads to other people that hopefully can, come to Christ as well, because there's just that, one other thing that, can help them along.
Awesome. And Otangelo Grasso, I don't know if you know Otangelo. Yeah,
I know Otangelo, absolutely.
he
thank
just
you
signed.
Otangelo.
And KR is saying, all right, he's going to hit you up about that television series after he wins the Powerball.
I'm there for you, buddy. I'm there.
Awesome. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much. This has been great and a lot of fun. And just so you know, the audience knows, up next, guess what? I've got two podcasts today. So tonight at 7 p.m., I'm going to be on the Faith Unaltered podcast, addressing a Muslim's objection to, he questions the historicity of Jesus being crucified, obviously on the basis of the Quran. So I'm going to be proving the historicity of the crucifixion and responding to the Muslim Islamic interpretation, where they try to go for a swoon theory or the twin theory, stuff like that. So I'm going to be refuting that. So
Oh,
yeah.
very interesting. Good for you. Awesome.
Thank you so much. Awesome. So I will see you guys at 7, but have a great day, everybody, and take care, Guy.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Dale. Thank you so much.
All right.